So in our study of 1 Corinthians, we've come to chapter 7, after a couple of hard chapters, 5 and 6. I don't like speaking of those things in those chapters, but I guess they were important enough to be put in the letter, and so we have to do that. But in chapter 7, things change somewhat. Instead of Gnosticism and spirits of promiscuity, Paul is going to give us some pastoral advice for relationships between men and women. And he's going to cover things like sexual relations in marriage, celibacy or marriage for the unmarried and the widow, divorce, the gift of remaining as we are before marriage, and advice on marriage for the betrothed and the widows. However, we're going to start with touching. It says in verse 1, it says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote me, it's good for a man not to touch a woman." There are those who, in the commentaries, interpret this as Paul saying it's good for a man and morally correct for a man not to touch a woman, even in marriage. However, if we look at the commentary from the New Testament, from the Talmud and Midrash, we're going to find that would not be the case within Judaism of the day. Strack and Bilderbeck, in their commentary on Corinthians, say this: "This principle did not align with views of the ancient synagogue. The common opinion of rabbinic scholars was, rather, that it was absolutely obligatory commandment for a man to get married." And I agree with this commentary. However, the Orthodox Jewish people do have a tradition that you do not touch or even shake hands with a woman. And I thought upon reading this that Paul was maybe referring to that tradition. However, not so, because if you look up the Greek word for touch there and combine it with the context that it's written in, you find something much different. The Greek word means of carnal intercourse with a woman or cohabitation. And so in looking at the definition of the Greek, you could translate it, "Now concerning the things by which you wrote me, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." Now, there are some that think, again, by the way this is written, that Paul is telling the Corinthians that celibacy would be the ideal, saying that it's better that men and women not marry. However, if we consider the phrase, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote me," I think we should consider that Paul is saying it's good for a man not to touch a woman in response to this question asked in the letter. And sadly, we're not privy to the question, only the answer. But I'm assuming from the rest of this section of the letter that he's referring to a sexual relations or touching outside of marriage, because that was the topic of the last chapter. And so while here in chapter 6 and in chapter 6, Paul refers to sex outside the marriage and the dangers of sex outside the marriage, and Paul will now speak of within the marriage. And so we're going to assume that that was speaking to the Corinthians in a more pastoral sense, of not touching a woman in a sexual manner outside the marriage. But now he says this: "But because of much immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." And so what I want you to note here is that Paul is not against marriage, but advocates for marriage. No doubt because of the environment in Corinth, the temptations outside of marriage are many. And so Paul says, let each man have a wife and each woman a husband. Paul is keeping with both common sense, Jewish tradition, and the scriptures when he says that. He's advocating for marriage. An early tradition from the Testament of Levi, as written around the 2nd century BCE, says this: "Be on guard against the spirit of promiscuity, for it is constantly active, and through your descendants is about to defile the sanctuary. Therefore, take for yourself a wife while you're still young, a wife who is free from blame or profanation, who is not from the race of alien nations." So here again, speaks of this spirit of promiscuity, in case you thought I was fooling about that. We've been speaking about it for the last couple of weeks, and it inhabited Corinth. However, now we're speaking of marriage. And if we follow rabbinic thought, we're going to find that this is a constant among the rabbis. The rabbis spoke of highly of marriage and considered it an obligation. Rav Huna from the 2nd century, common era, says this: "If someone is 20 years old and has not taken a wife, all his days are full of sins, of fornication. Do you really mean sins of fornication? Rather say, all his days are full of thoughts of sins of fornication. Again, so this is common thought among the rabbis. So for Paul to say it's good for a man not to marry, as some Christian commentators that I read said, we find that completely goes against Paul's training, the Word of God, and common sense. We also find this obligation to marry in later Talmudic traditions. Rabbi Elazar, citing the creation narrative, puts it this way, any man who does not have a wife is not a proper man. And again, he's citing the scripture in Genesis 2:24 that says, this is why a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh. And Paul quotes that same verse in Ephesians, Yeshua, in regard to divorce. One other Talmudic tradition says this, any man who has no wife lives without joy, without blessing, and without goodness. And when you read these things and you consider that Paul is a rabbinic student of Gamaliel, afterward becoming, as Paul puts it, a slave to Messiah, it's really difficult for me, or should be difficult for anyone, to consider that Paul is speaking against a committed marital relationship. And so Paul, in his typical hard to understand and easily twisted fashion, is really promoting marriage, as did his fellow rabbis. Chapter 7, verse 3 says, let the husband fulfill his obligation to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have rights to her own body, but the husband. Likewise, also, the husband does not have rights to his own body, but to the wife. Do not deprive one another except by mutual consent for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. And so what we see here is that Paul sees the value in marriage and the important role each partner has to play in that marriage, and how important it is for the partner to be faithful in that role, because by being faithful not to deprive one another, they each keep each other from temptation. Paul emphasizes this equal obligation of each partner, which have been probably been an eye-opener for many of the men of Corinth, because this was not the case with Romans and Greeks or anywhere really in the ancient world that I've ever read. Even in the modern world, if we look to the secular, or if we look to other religions like the Muslims, it's difficult to find this type of egalitarian attitude. Verse 6 says, but this I say as a concession, not as a command. This could be translated, I tell you this not as an order, but simply as permission. Paul makes it clear that he's not saying that everyone must marry. He's not commanding marriage, but he makes it clear that it's a good thing, but there are reasons for remaining single. But what he's saying is that because of much immorality and the constant temptations in Corinth, it's good to have a wife or a husband. You know, as we go through, I want to say this. As we go through these things, you have to remember he's speaking to the Corinthians, a very specific group of people with very specific problems in their lives. And so much of this, while it's good advice for the Corinthians, may not be as good advice for us. All right? And that's the way it is with all of the things that we're going to talk about as we go through Corinthians. He's addressing problems in Corinth that may not be problems here. All right? Verse 7 says, yet I wish that all men were like me. However, each man has his own gift from God, one this way, another that. So here Paul gives us his true opinion on celibacy or marriage. He relates them both as a gift of God, from God. For Paul, it would have been nearly impossible for him to marry or remarry and be an apostle to the non-Jews. Paul needed the freedom to travel, and that would have made it impossible to carry out the responsibilities he just laid out for a husband and wife. Not to mention the raising of children. The call that God had given him required the gift of remaining without a wife or children. Remaining unmarried in the Second Temple period for a Jew required the gift of God. To set aside all of the traditions about being married, as that we read earlier, and the criticism that would follow, would definitely require the gift of God. Not only would his life be a life missing the joy that we spoke about, missing the blessing, and missing the goodness of marriage, as Rabbi Tanhum said, by his fellow rabbis would have viewed his life without a wife as being not a proper man. As Rabbi Elazar said, without the gift of God, his days would have been full of sinful thoughts. He would have had to continually be on guard against that spirit of promiscuity, as another rabbi said. And so this is a gift from God to those whose task was given by God that would keep them from being a proper husband and father. However, without a task that required that gift, when you consider the joy, the blessing, the goodness of marriage, the joy and the blessing of having children, this too is a gift from God. And I believe that Paul is saying that both celibacy and the service of God and marriage and keeping the command of God are a gift given by God. And so Paul will give advice to those who have married and lost a spouse next. Experience the joy of that companionship, the joy of marriage. And he's also going to speak to those who have witnessed that joy from others. And he says this, but to the unmarried and to the widows, that is good for them to remain as I am. But if they don't have self-control, let them marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with desire. Again, Paul is saying that it takes a gift from God to live a life as he lived. And for those who don't have that gift, then it's good to marry. And once married and having that experience of joy, security, blessing, and companionship of marriage, then to lose that through death of your spouse, it would be difficult not to desire or to have those same blessings again. You're going to want those things once you've experienced them, in other words. And this verse opens the door for another question that many people ask that I really think we're just going to have to wait until that day to find out if Paul was ever married or if he was single all of his life. He speaks of widows and he says, remain single as I am. And so considering verse 8, we might want to consider that Paul was a widower. And if we look to Acts chapter 26 verse 10, it says this, and that is what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the Kedoshim in prisons by the authority I had received from the ruling Kohanim, but I cast my vote against them when they were being condemned to death. From this statement, we could conclude that he was a widower, as it would seem by voting for the death of the righteous that he was actually a member of the Sanhedrin and had the ability to vote one way or another. Members of the Sanhedrin had to be married, but there are others who think that Paul's wife divorced him when he came to faith in Messiah. There's a problem with that because in Israel, wives were not allowed to divorce. So his being a widower is the more likely option. Remain a female widow in Corinth would not have been an easy life. The Greco-Roman government did not provide support for the widows, as did the Jewish people, because they had the command of God to do so. In Corinth, the care of a widow was the responsibility of the men of her family. And so there would be a desire to remarry for the reasons I already stated above, but also for the men of her family because of the extra burden of caring for a widow. They would certainly have pressured her to remarry. Now, next we're going to come to a command, not an order from Paul. This is a command from God, and it says this. But to the married I command, not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to be separated from her husband. But if she gets separated, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband is not to divorce his wife. These verses are for a couple in Israel that would be a couple that are both believers. And to these believers, Paul is quite firm. A husband and a wife are not to divorce. And if problems arise, they're to reconcile. Plain and simple. Yeshua in the book of Matthew speaks to the Pharisees and says much the same thing, saying divorce and remarriage among the people of God is adultery. The people of Israel are God's chosen, and while God allowed divorce with a written notice, the people of God should live to God's original standards for marriage, that of being one. Just as the rabbis thought highly of marriage and that it was an obligation for a man and a woman to marry, Divorce was something that was frowned upon. And I know we read some traditions where it made it really simple. Rabbi Hillel made it as simple as burning dinner. But divorce was frowned upon. A good example of that is a rabbinic tradition that says when a man divorces his wife, even the altar of the temple sheds tears. The altar shedding tears is representative of the displeasure of God. Because a husband and wife are one, Yeshua calls divorce and remarriage actually adultery, showing how serious divorce is to Adonai. However, if we consider that, you know, here Paul is not speaking to Israel, and we should understand that Corinth is much different than Israel. And Paul's instructions to the Corinthians is going to be much different than Yeshua's instruction to the people of Israel. And no doubt why Paul, in speaking of divorce, does not follow Yeshua's guidelines and never calls divorce and remarriage adultery. Craig Keener, who, as I've said before, his primary focus is restoring the historical context to the Messianic writings, he says this: divorce was extremely common in Corinth, so that many members of the church had likely been remarried before conversion. Paul is not speaking to those who had read Torah all their lives or were teachers of the people who had followed God all their lives, circumcised into the covenant on the eighth day. No, Paul is speaking to Corinthians, former pagans, who are under Roman law. And Roman law concerning divorce was much more permissive, even allowing a woman to divorce her husband, which would not have been allowed in Israel. So Keener says this, goes on, he says this: Jesus warned men against divorce. Greek and Roman law, however, predicated marriage on mutual consent, so the principle in this setting addresses both genders, because either could institute divorce. The context here, as Keener said, people who had married before they ever heard a word of the good news, couples where one had received the good news and believed, and the other was a pagan. And so now he says this: but to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, if any brother who has a wife who is a believer and she agrees to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if any woman has a husband who is not a believer and he agrees to live with her, she must not divorce him. And again, Keener puts this into its context. Many Corinthians, mostly converted after their marriages, apparently wanted a more spiritual union, hence wanted to end their marriages on the grounds of spiritual incompatibility, and Paul admonishes them not to break up with spouses simply because they are unbelievers. Again, we see Paul's deep respect for marriage, even telling the unevenly yoked not to divorce. And in speaking of divorce and remarriage, I wish I had a dollar for every time I've been asked about this passage or the one where Yeshua speaks of divorce, because if I did, we could pay off the mortgage on this building. And the reason is simple. The same problem exists today. Paul is pro-marriage and against divorce. And if the husband is kind and loving, or the wife is kind and loving, even though they're not believers, Paul says they are to remain with them. For you don't know that upon witnessing the changes in you, the love and the kindness and the compassion and the grace that you show, they may then listen to you of the gospel and be saved. But what happens if an unbeliever does not want to remain, or perhaps the unbeliever becomes unfaithful or abusive or leaves home? What is God's view of divorce under those circumstances? Is divorce allowed then? This frequently happens in marriages today. A secular couple is married. One of them has the good news witnessed to them. And that kind of sows division in the marriage. And the marriage finally fails. So the woman comes to me and says, or the man comes to me and says, and asks, I should say, if after divorce they can be remarried. Well, I'll just tell you what God said, not what I said. This is what God said, not me, as Paul would say. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1 says, suppose a man takes a wife and marries her. Now, if she doesn't find favor in his eyes because he has found something indecent about her, he is to write her a certificate of divorce, hand it to her, and send her out of his house. When she leaves the house, she may go and become another man's wife. The truth is, God not only permits divorce, but he also permits remarriage after divorce. And as the rabbi said, the altar of God may weep, meaning God's not happy, but in his compassion, he allows divorce. Now, if we go to the book of Mark, I'm going to read what Yeshua has to say about this. The Pharisees came up, and to test him, they began to asking, is it permitted for a man to divorce his wife? And he replied to them, what did Moses command you? And the Pharisee said, Moses permitted a man to write a bill of divorce and to put her away. But Yeshua said to them, because of the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this command. And so here Yeshua speaks of the passage we just read in Deuteronomy and tells us that God compromised, so to speak, because of the hardness of the human heart and gave permission to divorce. And so what Yeshua is saying is that God gave you permission to divorce even though it wasn't a good thing, it wasn't his perfect will, but he gave you permission because he knew of the hardness of the heart. If we go on, it says this in verse 6. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. And for this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. And so God's perfect will is that we do not divorce because we become one with our spouse. However, should the circumstances of life arise, as with a spouse who is abusive, unfaithful, or a non-believer who leaves the home, then God in his compassion does allow divorce. And not just divorce, but he also allows remarriage. And that's the law concerning marriage and divorce. Not going to change. No laws in the Torah change. Not even Yeshua changed it because he said, not one letter will pass away until all things be accomplished. That said, Paul is also saying for two who are serious about walking with God, divorce between two who believe isn't an option. Yeshua tells us that divorce is not an option because the two who are serious about walking with Yeshua are going to work it out. And Paul is now going to tell the Corinthians why it's important to remain married even to a non-believer. In verse 14 he says, for the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if an unbeliever separates, let him be separated. The brother or sister is not bound in such cases, but God has called you to shalom. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And again, it's the same thing I said before. But again, if a spouse leaves, then the person is not bound to that person any longer and may seek divorce, as prescribed in Deuteronomy. Paul is not easy to understand, particularly in these passages. But here, I told David, I said, doing Corinthians is really hard. Because what Paul spends chapters on, I could say in just a couple of minutes. But when you're going through verse by verse, okay? So, in essence, he's saying what I said earlier. The unbeliever's life may be changed because of the changes in the life of those of a believing spouse. And not only that, but you also must consider the children. What are the consequences? What will the consequences be because of your leaving? However, I would add, if the spouse were abusive or unfaithful, you still have to consider the effects of the children. What will the effects be on their life?